Hello, howdy, how's everybody doing? This is Poet Runner. I have my co-host, Richard Modiano, and first we have Tina Duran, a poet who's on Flower Song Press, and she's actually going to let us talk to her about her work. Hello.
Hello. Pleasure to meet you.
Same
to be on your show.
Let me ask you, Gina, is And So the Wind Was Born your latest?
It's my first.
Your first.
Yeah, it's my debut. Mm-hmm.
Well, another coup for Flower Song Press.
Yeah.
No, seriously.
Yeah.
And in reading the book, what I picked up on, there is a sort of, you have a large range from going from poetry that is about private epiphany, private travail, to social issues, and the collection is full of that. So it's not a one note collection, and also it is stylistically versatile as well, I thought. So that we have short lyrical poems, and we have prose poems too. And what was your plan in putting this book together?
Well, I started it like 5 years ago, just for starters, and it originally was going to be a book of love poems. And as time went on, I had changed my mind and just kept adding more works to where I wanted to show how love can be healing, and not just like romantic love. I meant it as spiritual and familial and communal. And self-love too. So I wanted to show people the transformation, and that's the reason why I dive deeply into myself first before I go outward to look at the world, to show how people need to heal in general in our community.
Yeah, I thought that was a very good approach for the whole book, to start with yourself and go outward, because we do want to know something about the writer. We want to know what her concerns are, where she's coming from, to get an idea of her own personal sensibility. And your work is both intimate, and it's written in a language that can reach out to other people. It is not really strictly you don't have to. You don't have to be a woman. You don't have to be queer. You don't have to be young. I'm an old man, so I'm a straight old white man, and I got it. So
good. I'm glad.
and that is really what elevates poetry, is this ability to make your own experiences resonate with somebody that is totally unlike you. You have to have a command of language to be able to do that, so that any reader can identify with this. Any reader will appreciate the poems in this book. Any reader will be able to see how they can apply to their own lives or be touched by that. I mean, there's like a common underlying humanity. That's what I'm getting at in these poems.
Yeah. And I mean, my radio show is also about that, too. It's about communal love and just the idea that we all are in need of healing. And the biggest thing that I did was make sure that I wrote from a perspective of wind instead of being a human. And though I do speak about being a child and things like that, it's always the wind is doing this and the wind is doing that. You know, the love character that is in there is also the wind. So, and different types of wind too. We're both different types of wind.
Yes, that came across beautifully. So I wonder, since we're talking about the wind, would you mind reading the first poem in the book, Fire and Wind?
Oh, one of the first ones? Okay, this is on page 13. All right. Fire and Wind. Fire is a common occurrence. Fire is a common occurrence in California and the power of the Santa Ana winds. decimate, evaporate, dissipate the green through a straw like a greedy child with sticky hands. Fire is a common occurrence. Fire is a common occurrence amongst the brittle, drought-ridden weeds where field mice and gophers scurry, play, frolic in kumquat trees, and birds flutter quick as dogs run free down empty roads like almond, cypress, banana, and harupa, where a long stretch of gravel begins to roll with the hills. As a pitta girl called to the wind while falling to her knees, begging Jesus in the cleft of the southeast corner of her hot pink carpeted room, in the silence, the wind emptied from her lungs, raging the sizzles and chews of flames. In the silence, a puff of dirt alerts when visitors pass. In the silence, the wind cries between the window pane, tapping Christmas lights against the frame. Under the tinseled tree is a stretched blue knitted sweater, newly worn and thrown across the living room floor of a swollen-lipped and purple-faced girl. In the silence, God is not questioned, and Dad's heavy, calloused hands build bridges and skyscrapers to futures where high winds are God. And blue-collar Catholics spend 7 a.m. Sundays giving gratitude for cushioned falls. But in the silence, fire devours everything, as a young girl screams, but no one does a thing. In the silence, the fire is seen, but no one does a thing.
That's outstanding. Yeah, that really sets it up for me for the rest of this book. And I notice, well, we already, you already talked about how a wind is a recurring symbol, or not exactly symbol, but it's a recurring theme that that takes different forms. So that's very protean, and I thought that was very skillfully handled throughout the book. And I noticed that there is. What I, the other thing that I liked about it is that we're hitting on all of the five senses. We're getting sight, we're getting sound, we're getting touch, feeling, we're getting odors, and the other, the earth appears in this as well as the wind. There is the solidity of earth and what the earth means. And then there were, of course, the recurrence of the aurora borealis, this beautiful color, the colors that come from basically an area of cold and chill, but nonetheless have a kind of warmth to it, the way you handled the aurora borealis, and I thought that was also really good.
Thank you. The aurora borealis is the wind of the sun, so that's why I included it. And I also wanted, because, again, it's this whole metaphor, right? I use magical realism. And so I wanted to make sure that I did a lot of research on different types of wind first. And then when I went to do the aurora borealis, that was the more healing aspect. But I also had to cover what was happening in society. But I wanted to show how this character then evolved beyond herself and to look outward. So this way I'm looking at not just introspectively, but empathetically. And so I had to do research on that and on fusion of the sun.
The superstructure of the research is so skillfully embedded that it seems organic to me. That was my take on that. And by the way, I used to share an office with Will Alexander, who was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize for poetry recently. And,
oh, wow.
And people used to think that Will spun this stuff right out of his head without any type of reference. Well, Will had encyclopedias and dictionaries piled almost to the ceiling when he was working on his poems.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That is awesome. I love that. I remember seeing him. I was watching someone who was also a newspaper writer who had, you know, piles and piles of newspapers and books and things. And my son said, that's the dream. And he wasn't being sarcastic. That is the dream when you're a writer, right? To just, like, have piles of books.
Yeah, yeah. And would you mind reading one of the more intimate ones?
Sure.
Lunchbox messages.
Okay, yeah. So one of the reasons why, just to put this out there, why I decided to continue to use the lunchbox messages, aside from the fact that I wanted to show that love is healing, and she's like kind of a symbol of, you know, community and familial type of love as well. But it's also because there's so much trauma involved. I want to be able to, like, release people of that stress and go back and forth in time. And a lot of time is affected through these characters as well. I focus a lot on time, and it's to show that it's not lineal and it's more cyclical. So, okay, lunchbox message, captivated. I cannot look into your eyes or I will be captivated in a sea of green and flecks of gold, never wanting to return. Eyes so gentle yet intense, sending me into a whirlwind. My mind keeps whirling and twirling like the wind beneath your skirt. My heart is catching on fire, beating through my swollen throat. When all I want to do is whisper, I love you. I love you. Instead, I mutter, I am sorry, because I am sorry. I cannot be what you wanted. My mind keeps whirling and twirling like the wind beneath your skirt. And all I want to do is yell, get out of the wind. You are too beautiful to stand in the wind. Instead, I point and stammer, and you remain in the wind. You are too beautiful to stand in the wind. I cannot look into your eyes, or I will be captivated. But you are free, and all I want is you to be free with me. That's actually the first poem that I wrote that made me decide I was going to write a book. So I love that you chose that one. That's the poem that started it all.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, it has. There's a lot of energy and power in that poem. That's why I wanted to read this one.
I love that you picked it.
It's got a lot of feeling.
Thank you.
Well, I know that you mentioned. Sure, I was going to say. I know that you mentioned magic realism, and for our readers who may not be familiar with magic realism, it's basically a style, or maybe you might even call it a genre of writing that is reality based, based on the real world, and then moves sort of laterally into the fantastic. And I wondered if you deliberately picked that prism of magic realism because it has a sort of a not exactly an insulating function, possibly an insulating function for you, the poet, but it certainly is a captivating way of writing. Was this like a conscious decision, or did you just feel drawn to it? It just came out that way.
It was a conscious decision. Not when I was writing the poetry about the first love poems that I started, like, with Captivated. That one, yeah. I was just becoming, like, very obsessed with the wind at that time. And it wasn't until I started writing for my poetry thesis, my art and poetry. So I say thesis because it's for art and poetry. I had two. And so I wanted to include that aspect in both my art and my poetry. And I wanted again, it was more so using that effect because I wanted people to be able to identify with my character without it being so personal. Like, I wanted it to be able to be anybody. And so
yeah.
I felt that taking myself and making myself as a wind was the best way to do that and to take them into a whole new world that was kind of both traumatic and surreal. And I wanted them to be able to see that they could be this character too, that anybody could be this character. You know, and I'm also, since I'm gender fluid, I have these feelings of both masculine and feminine, and by me being wind, I can be those things without it being about whether I wear a dress or, you know, pants or, you know, whether I have short hair or long hair, you know, it doesn't matter.
Well, that comes through very, you succeeded, let's put it that way. It really worked to bring in, well, it certainly worked to bring me in. And as I mentioned earlier, we are completely different in our, well, we're just male, female, straight, gender fluid, old, young, et cetera. And I got it, and it came over to me. That is one of the things that I really like about your poetry, is that it is accessible. That's what I'm trying to say. It's accessible. It's not like a Chinese wall that you have to decode and penetrate and try and figure out what's going on. It's like, you know, to me, the best poetry, you could say, works on at least two levels. There is a surface level where you know what's happening. You don't have to try and figure out what are they trying to say. We know what they're trying to. We know what they are saying. But there's a second layer. There's a sort of an outer meaning and an inner meaning, and this inner meaning is what, you know, elevates the poem for me. It's like, you know, you go in through the outer. You approach the poem through the surface, but as the poem develops, you were drawn into it, into this inner meaning, and this is where the emotion comes in. This is where the emotion of the poet reaches the reader and provokes their own emotion, the reader's own resonating emotional response, if I can put it that way.
Through the magical realism. Yeah, I think so. And I think also one of the nice things about magical realism, too, is that I can play with time. And one of the things that someone had noticed about it is they're kind of like, you know, it's just kind of, oh my goodness, I can't even think of the terminology, but it's like when everything just kind of happens, you're like following, it's just free flowing. And so you're just continuously writing. Though I wrote all these poems at different times, I feel kind of like, I set in, like, say, a love poem near another poem that has to do with the same idea that I might have been thinking about around the time that I wrote the love poem. And the interesting thing about time is that though we are in the present, we are always experiencing the past and the future at the same time. That's what makes the present who we were, who we want to be, you know, our plans of the future. And then there's just right now. And so I feel kind of like, you know, those swirls in time are in ancient drawings. You see those swirls. And so you know that you're existing all at the same time. Both past, present, and future are existing simultaneously through you. And I feel kind of like with magical realism, you can see that. You can see that the person is experiencing their trauma in the present and that they're looking for healing in it for the future. So I feel like that all works together with magical realism.
And it worked perfectly, I thought.
Thank you.
And of course, the way you deploy, I mean, it takes a certain skill to deploy magical realism at its deepest, and I think you succeeded in that. We talked about reading another poem. What pick something of your own that you think would that you like in the book.
Okay. Well, that's not too long. So I'm going to read Stolen Wind.
Okay.
And this is one of my prose. The thick sepia-stained air split onto the sun, the color of burnt orange, seeping through clouds of billowing smoke. I wandered out to raining ash and cooled ember puddles on my bare toes to attempt to play in my garden and talk to my plants. Normally, the lavender and sage swim in the scent of redwood chips, but today the stale sun ferments under the sapper of soot and seasons the soil with the flavors of Redlands, California. Not because the sun was so hot it rotted, withered, and singed the fruits of our labors, or even because some careless camper forgot that campfires are hazardous in the arid summer heat. No. A puff of blue shot out to reveal the news of some child's genitalia, a child who will forever remember that their family's repugnance destroyed 20,000 acres of wildlife. And they weren't the first. Why? Ignorance and hate are burning down the country with their constructs, gender, sexuality, xenophobia, racism. Breonna Taylor was murdered in her sleep, and no one did a thing. Her wind was stolen. The police officer was punished for shooting a bullet through a wall. The wall received restitution. It will rest in peace. It was probably white. George Floyd's last words were, "I can't breathe," while his wind was crushed by racist blue life. I have yet to meet a blue person, but I hear their lives matter every time a black person is murdered by one. White supremacists, militia, and anti-vaxxers stood with shotguns in red, white, and blue. The country reopened. Ahmaud Arbery was chased, beaten, and gunned down, never to feel the breath of the sun again. The raging fire scorched the earth because black football players can't kneel during the anthem. The Navajo are suffocating from COVID-19, their lungs deprived of air for their ancestors who breathed as they walked before the soil was colonized. Brown and black bodies are gathered in a pile, hung in trees, sex trafficked, stolen. But soon, no one will suffer in cages or lie on the streets in their broken vessels of bones. The choice of life has been cut from the bodies of non-white women. Forced sterilization. Eugenics. Genocide. Genocide is the fire ignited at the parties of racists. Dead people don't celebrate gender reveal parties, and queer and trans people celebrate coming out after they shed their forced gender roles. When I see the slinky, swirling movements of the aurora borealis dissolving and transforming like watercolor on a black canvas sky, I think how beautiful it must be to be without borders. How beautiful it must be to exist through an electromagnetic pull, becoming one with the universe and the earth, where all the colors exist in a symphony of light. Thank you.
Oh, that's great. Symphony of light.
That's a really strong piece. I really love the piece. I love all the images, and I love everything that you brought up. I mean, you brought up a lot in one poem. There's a lot of things that you brought up. No, there's a lot of things that you brought up, and the whole thing with the blue, I've known good and bad blue. So I'm kind of torn about blue because I've had some friends that took care of me when I was bad, and I've been beaten by the blue. So I don't, I'm kind of torn about how to feel.
I have family and friends that are officers, so I'm sure that they I'm not talking about those guys. I'm talking about people who abuse their power. And saying blue life, I think, honestly, is really hurtful, to be honest.
I think so, too.
Because they're not blue. They're not blue. They wear a uniform, and they can be whatever color they are, you know? Like,
Well, it can stop being blue.
Even if you're white and you put on a blue uniform, the uniform can still come off and people will look at you and not think that you're a police officer, That's a uniform. Whereas a person who's a person of color, especially a black or an indigenous person, they're completely incapable of changing that. Their bone structure, their skin. Yeah, you can't. Yeah. You can't change your bone structure either, because as a person who's indigenous and Latina, people come up to me and want to know, if I'm indigenous all the time. And I have to deal with the comments that come with it, too, because it's not just, complimentary either. It's a lot of times I do get, harassed, too. So I can't change that, and I'm not dark. I'm light-skinned, so, my bones can't change.
I get the opposite. People think I'm white.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah?
No, it's hilarious to me ever since I was little, because as soon as I went to school, the head nun said, Raphael's a little hard for our students. We're going to call you Ralph. So I got renamed. I'm like, but, that's not my name. Yeah.
Ralph? From Raphael to Ralph?
Yeah. I hated Ralph. I mean, the problem is my brothers call me Ralph, and they're used to it. And it's like, my name's Raphael. Raphael, mm-hmm. Ralph. I don't like Ralph. Never have.
I wouldn't either, especially if that's the name people kept giving me and when my name was actually Raphael.
Yeah,
I can understand that. I think it is also just frustrating for people to just make things about skin tone, though, in general.
It's nuts. No, it's nuts. I mean,
we're all human beings.
My roommate who passed, she could pass for white, and when she was hanging out with little Richard, they would make her go out and buy the food because she could go into the diner. They couldn't.
Mm.
But she hated doing it because she's like, they might figure out I'm not white. And then there'll be a whole bunch of trouble.
That would be scary for her, too, if they figure out she's not white.
Yeah, and she went through that growing up. I mean, she got shit for for being light. And not being accepted by her own because she was too light and she could pass.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't fun for her.
Is she?
But we got 3 minutes.
Are you? Huh?
Mm-hmm. No, go ahead. What were you gonna ask?
Oh, okay. I was gonna ask what your ethnicity is.
Guatemalan, Costa Rican.
Oh, okay. Guatemalan, Costa Rican. So they and people. Make it about your skin tone.
I mean,
yeah.
They think I'm German or Jewish. I'm like, no. Not German.
When I was younger, my bone structure wasn't as strong, so I would get that I was white more often than I do now. But now I'm like, I don't know what it is. Like, as we get older in my family, our bone structure just kind of, gets stronger. I don't know. It's kind of interesting. Yeah.
Yep. Well, we got We got 2 minutes for the next guest. Is there anything, Richard, you want to ask before we close the show, close her segment of the show?
Well, yes, Gina, what's coming up? Any new work?
Oh, yeah, promote.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so I have some workshops coming up. They're community workshops. And one is in, both of them are July. July 10th will be at the Sims Library. Oh, no, wait. Excuse me. That was when we were supposed to do the Poet Runner. I'm sorry. I have one coming up at Sims Library, and you can find that on Eventbrite. And then I also have one at Via Chucha's, and that one will be on the 23rd. And that was PM, and it's a two-part workshop. The first one is for community care, self-care, and the second one is also a community project, but it's community care is self-care. So I'm just essentially taking people through, you know, how to mindfulness, safe space, courageous space, embrace our mistakes, breath work for stress or anxiety, really shame, embrace the humble, show up, write your truth, and then we're going to do permissions. That's the first one. And then we're going to do like kind of an exquisite corpse. And then the second one is we're going to do interviewing skills and learning how to listen, because these are things that we need to learn how to do as community. And then we're going to do a huge workshop that, like a whole community poem to find the things that we have in common. So that's kind of what I teach a lot with my foster youth. And a lot of people have asked me, you know, to bring it to the community and, like, you know, make it accessible to everyone. So that's what I'm doing with these next two workshops in July.
I sound good. They sound very good.
Yes, they do.
Thank you.
And thank you for coming on the show. And
okay.
Yeah, we look forward to hearing more from you. And it was great having you on. And, you know, thank you for letting us read your work and letting us have you on the show.
Yeah. Yeah, we've been talking, just listeners, we've been talking to Gina Duran, author of And So the Wind Was Born. And it's available directly from the publisher, Flower Song Press. And I recommend that you try them first. Try your local independent bookstore. And as a last resort, go to Amazon. But publisher first, local independent bookstore second. Yeah.
Right.
Thank God I'm not trying to get Amazon to support me.
Well, when they support you, I'll drop that part.
No, I'm never going to ask Amazon, but I just think it's funny. Like, hey, would you like to support me? But what about what your co-editor says? I mean, co-host says on the end of the show. Yeah, no. If you guys got a lot of money, you know, just, don't worry about it. But, you know.
Okay.
Thanks a lot for being on the show.
Thank you. And have a wonderful day.
You too.
You too.
Okay, bye-bye.
So now we have Sanjay, and I do not want to mispronounce your name. That's the last name. I think it's, I keep looking at it, but I don't think I'm getting it right. How are you?
I'm great. The last guest was amazing. I really loved listening to what she had to say. I'm looking forward to this interview. I hope we can follow that.
Well, you've done 153 marathons. I mean, that in itself is kind of amazing. I mean, that's a lot of. When did you start doing marathons to get that number?
Well, it's 158 marathons. I started in 2003. My father had passed away from stomach cancer the September of the year prior, and he had discovered it in January that he had stomach cancer of that same year, the stage 4. So they were told, and I was told, that he wouldn't make it to the end of the year. He never knew me as an athlete, so I got into running. And 2 weeks before he died, I ran my first half marathon. Then I thought, okay, I'll run my full marathon, and no one believed me. So in the fall, there was a 91-year-old man running his first marathon in Toronto, Fallujah Singh. And he inspired me so much, I just kept running. And I realized that, you know, people who tell me that they hate running don't get running. You know, it's all about the community there. And the people you meet, and everyone has a story. It's so motivational. And when you get to the ultramarathon community, which I've started doing a lot of, that's totally different as well. It truly is a community. It's a group run, whether or not you believe it or not, it really is. And the love and the support, you don't get that anywhere else. And after COVID, I really needed that. I was really missing a lot of that. We were locked down harder than most countries in Canada. And this is what sort of brought me back to life. The expectation of the marathon was coming. And, you know, as a Canadian, every American state has been so welcoming to me. And I just look forward to discovering more states and making more friends. Sorry for the long-winded answer. It's sprawling. But it's Sanjay, by the way.
How many states have you ran in?
I've done 27 states. I try to add an extra couple every year. And I've gone more towards the ultras just because, you know, I meet such great people. And, I mean, in general, most of them who've gone in the ultra community have overcome some great hardships, whether it be addiction issues or financial issues or whatever, and they're so willing to share the lessons they've learned in their lives. So you become not only a better runner at the end of the race, but a better person.
Huh. How many ultras have you done?
Well, in total, I've done 158 ultras and fulls. I think I probably just around a dozen ultras, I'd say. I've got more ultras signed up for the rest of the year in Bowling Green, Kentucky. I've got one in September, and I've got one in Iowa, Des Moines, Iowa, as well, the Equalizer race. I do the Savage 7 series in Florida with JC. He's a great race director, and you meet some great people there. And I do the mainly marathons as well, which is good if you want to try to do multiple races because there's no time limit, and they feed you like an ultra. So you are well taken care of.
I call this a baby ultra because it's 31 miles, but I'm doing my first ultra in August.
Oh, great. Which race is it?
The Bulldog in California.
Okay. And which city in California?
I think it's, I'm not sure, it's somewhere in, all I know is I signed up for it and it's like 31 miles and I've been training for it. I mean, I got a half marathon coming up this week and then I got about 4 or 5 marathons left for the year. How many marathons do you do a year?
Prior to lockdown, I was doing about 17 or 18 a year. Just because where I live in Ottawa, with a tank of gas, I can get to so many races. I wanted to support a lot of the race directors in the area, in Northeast U.S. So I always say that, you know, when you climb to the top of the mountain, when you do your initial 16-week plan to be a marathoner, why run down the mountain just as quick? You know, just do a race every 3 weeks, and you can still maintain that form. Now, after a while, you don't run for a time. You just run for fun. So races in the beginning when I started are very different than the races now. I mean, they're more relaxed. I take my time. You know, if it's a really hot day, the last few races where it's like plus 35, or I guess in Fahrenheit, like 90, 95, I'm not used to that. So I tend to walk more than I run. So it's 7.5, 8-hour day, but that's okay. I mean, I'm spending all the time meeting new people and talking. And because I've got to drive 6, 7 hours back to Canada afterwards, I want to make sure I'm fresh for that.
Huh. I mean, there's all types of people I've talked to. I mean, some people, you know, when they train, they look at their pace. They want to keep a certain pace. When I train, I just want to run and maintain, you know, the doing it of every day, not the how fast did I run. I mean, some days I'll think about how fast I ran, but most days it's just I just want to do the run and enjoy it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And you know, as you start doing it, it becomes part of your life. It's just the fact that you're doing it is pleasure enough, you know. Sometimes, like I said, you know, when I run in the morning, there's some people who have seen me for a while, and they high five me. I would never talk to them during regular work day just because I'm just so focused on other things. But it is great to get out there, and like I said, getting that fresh oxygen, getting that fresh air, and like even waving at other runners is great too.
It's kind of funny because some days I don't feel like doing it, and like 3 to 4 miles. 5 miles, I'm fine. I'm back and I'm coasting and I feel good. But sometimes the first couple of miles, you're like, why did I start?
I feel like that as well. During lockdown, I was always used to training for a race. And originally in Canada, we were told just 2 weeks, you know, and then we'll reopen. And they just kept extending. And I was canceling races left and right. I think in 2020, I canceled 17 trips to the States. And it just killed me because I was missing out. Of course, my friends in the States. But being locked down, you know, if you went for a run, you have to be careful. Like if I ran through a dog walk park, if I didn't have a dog with me, I could actually get fined. You know, there's all these crazy things you have to keep in mind as you're running.
Oh, yeah.
So it wasn't even this kind of thing where I can even forget about the problems in my world. I have to keep – and as well, like, you have to sort of prove that it was essential, too. We had just crazy rules. And, I mean, everyone agreed to it. Canadians tend to be more compliant, but – for me, anyway, it was a lot more challenging, and it did affect me mentally. Like, there were days I just couldn't run. I would just sit at the edge of my steps and say, not today. I just can't do it today. And it was just because of just everything on my mind. And as things opened up and I could get to the States, you know, I don't know. The air is different down here in the States. I just felt like $1 million, you know. I felt, I'm back. My running's maybe not been where I want it to be, but hey, I'm still doing it, and you know, I'm still getting down there. So yeah. Thank you for having me on your show to share this story. So.
No, these are great stories. I mean, I like your enthusiasm. I mean, I'm definitely the same way about running. I mean, it's like, I found out it's normal to have 16 pairs of shoes. I thought that wasn't normal. I found out it's normal to run with toilet paper in your pocket just in case. I found all these things that I thought were normal that I was doing. It's normal, you know? Poop in your pants, no big deal. People do it once in a while when they run. I thought that was, like, you know, weird. But it turns out it happens. You know, all this stuff that you learn, you know, as you, like, become serious about what you're doing.
Well, and you know, when I'd run marathons, I always carried extra gels with me because, you know, a lot of the first-timers, usually around, you know, 21, 22 miles, they want to quit. And I give them extra gel, give them a pep talk, and I say, like, look, I'll finish with you, and if you want, I'll stop so that you could finish and say you beat me if it means something to you. I remember I think it was my third or fourth marathon. It was Take Your Kid to Work Day. One of my coworkers brought their 8-year-old son to me. And he came up to, and he had a marathon shirt on it. And I said, hey, you know, you're going to run a marathon one day? And he said, yeah, I'm going to run one coming up in 3 months. I said, you are? And his mother, who's my coworker, said, yeah, no one wants to train him. And I said, I can help him. And he was an 8-year-old kid. And I said, okay, I'll tell you what to do. And on the day of the race, I said, okay, if you do what I tell him, I told his parents, if he does what I tell him to do, I'll let him beat me. But if not, he's on his own. So he saw the Kenyans and wanted to run with them, and I go, okay, have a good race, kid. And he did finish, and he wore his medal to school every week. And I remember members of the Canadian Olympic team were contacting me saying, that kid could have died. And I said, look, you know, when we were kids, you know, and me, and I'm 50 this year, when I was a kid and all my friends, we'd be outside playing all day. You know, I'm sure we ran a marathon the way we were playing soccer all day, you know, playing baseball, playing road hockey. That's what we did all day. Kids today just want to stay indoors and play video games. I mean, he did follow a training plan, so I wasn't worried about him. And he did finish. So,
what did you think about the six-year-old who, you know, the family got in all types of trouble for having him in the marathon?
You know what? As long as there's proper nutrition and he's being supervised by an adult, I'm not too worried about that. Like I said, I mean, my next-door neighbor is a retired nurse, retired nun. She's in her 80s, and they do the El Camino walk every year, and it's from Spain to France. And again, she's in her mid-80s, and she carries a 30-pound backpack, and she walks, she does 25 to 30 kilometers every day for, like, 2 or 3 months to get to her destination. And she said every Catholic has to do it, and, you know, she does it every year, and she's in her mid-80s, so... I think again, if you are properly hydrated, then you should be able to do it. I wouldn't. If he was being pushed, I would be against that. But if he went at his own pace, and like I said, had proper nutrition, proper hydration, and finished, I have no problems with that.
I don't know what happened, but the thing is, I heard he was breaking down crying. I think once he started breaking down and crying, you gotta let him stop. But at the same time. You know how they egg them on. The thing that gets me about how they egg them on, we'll give you extra sheaves of Pringles. I'm like, if the kid finishes the marathon, give him something more than Pringles. You know? And that's just me. I just thought, like, wait a minute. This kid's just run 26 miles and you're giving him just Pringles? I think he deserves something better than that. I mean, that's just me. I mean, I just...
Well, you know, it's amazing because most people, first-timers will say, oh, I'm going to just pig out. I'm going to eat cookies. I'm going to eat ice cream. And I'm like, you want to eat foods that are naturally anti-inflammatory. They're better, eat the salmon, the turmeric powder, the almonds. That's what I eat. And because I started doing doubles before lockdown and I'm starting up again, I did my last double in New York, New Jersey, where you run one marathon Saturday, another Sunday. And the food you eat in between is so important. And you don't eat that junk food. I mean, people want to because they think it's a pleasure at the end of it or that's my treat for doing this. I'm like, you're actually harming your body by doing this. And don't be too reliant on those pills, like those aspirin and Tylenol, because there are side effects to it.
There's side effects to everything.
Nutrition is so important.
No, I agree. How does the body take two marathons in a row?
So usually when I first started doing it, there's a woman, she was a lawyer from Alaska, was living in Pennsylvania, and she could tell I was nervous, and she said, hey, do you want to run with me? I said, sure. And she said, okay. It was mainly marathons has a thing during the summer, you can do 20 marathons in 20 states in 20 days. And she explained, on the first day, you run 10 seconds, walk 9 minutes, 50 seconds, and you do that for the whole marathon. So it's an 8-hour day. The second day, you walk 15, or you run 15 seconds, walk 9 minutes, 45 seconds. And so every day, you're getting faster. So every day, you're looking forward to the next race. And that's what kept her going for 20 straight days of running. And I was like, wow, that actually makes sense. And that way, by the end of the series, you're running your fastest race. And I did it that way, and, you know, because only 2 days, my walk breaks were longer on the second, or my run breaks were longer on the second day, and I was able to finish, like, almost an hour faster than the day before. So I thought, okay, this is how I personally do it. But, yeah. I mean, I just started just as a challenge to myself, and because they had no time limit, I said, okay, it doesn't matter. I'll take my time. If it's a bad day, it's a bad day. People really think they have done it. But because I was so successful the first time, I want to do it more often. Mm-hmm. And it saved money on travel because the states are usually a couple hours apart. So it saves me some money there too.
Wow. Huh. That's pretty cool. I mean, hey, what do you prefer, trail runs or the street runs?
I'm not used to that much trail running. I live downtown in Ottawa, so a lot of it's the street running. The one advantage of street running, of course, when you're running in the morning is you can arrange it so that you run by all the gas stations. So if you do have to use the bathroom, you can go rush in and do that instead. The trail running, I find it's just I'm not used to it. So for me, I'm always at risk of, like, tripping or falling. So I actually just walk most of the trails just because I'm not used to the surface ground level. But, yeah.
You know what's funny about your statement? I trip on pavement more than I trip on the trail runs. I don't trip on a trail run.
Oh, okay.
I trip on pavement because of erosion or whatever.
Okay.
I mean, Sunday I actually took a pretty good header because out of nowhere there's like this bump in the road and my foot clicked and I went flying. I saved my phone, messed up my elbow. Did not let the phone hit the floor, but my elbow hit it pretty good. Most people go, why'd you save your phone? Go ahead.
I find like now Canada, the winters are bad, so there's a lot of potholes, so you have to be more careful with the potholes as you run. So that I can see that happening, especially if there's uneven pavement and stuff. That could happen, too.
No, it sucks. It messes you up, and you're just like, ah, crap, I could just stand there. Yeah, I got to keep going. So, you know, you just get back up and keep running, but it's still like, oh, man, it kind of hurts, but at least I'm not limping. You know, but...
Well, when you get the adrenaline flow, the pain sort of stays away. But when it hits, like 2-3 hours later, yeah, you feel it. Like,
yeah. Why didn't I stop? Oh, yeah, because I'm stupid. And I'm stubborn. And I like to finish. So, yeah, so basically, there we go. What's the difference for you when you train for an ultra than when you train for a marathon? Does your nutrition change? Does your eating change?
My training, like the most I train is maybe a 10-miler between races. With the ultras, my nutrition does change a bit because I tend to eat more natural foods, if you will. I try to eat more pure foods anyway. I've changed my diet to help lose weight, but basically the night before the race, I'll have fish and chips. Fish is usually I don't like fried stuff, so I try to get something a lot more, you know, barbecued fish or whatever. And then instead of the French fries, I'll have like baked potatoes. And then during the race of an ultra, both the mainly marathons and Savage 7, they have hot and cold food for you. But at the ultras, they will serve like grilled cheese sandwiches. And I just get the pickle juice every hour and bananas and things like that to replace the energy. And then near the end, as I'm really lagging, I'll start to eat the more like baked potatoes to keep me going to the end. But again, a lot depends just on the weather. And during a marathon, I wouldn't eat anything. I just survive on gels. I don't eat anything before the race. And then usually 12 hours before the race, I don't eat anything as well. So I have an empty stomach.
Same
and
here.
And in terms of, I add Ultima to my Gatorade, and that gets rid of my cramps as well for longer races too.
Huh. What's Ultima?
Ultima, it's about 5-6 years ago, I noticed I'd get cramps in my calves at around 21 miles. And I didn't understand because my legs felt good. And they explained that as you get older, you lose magnesium or the ability to absorb magnesium. So I started just taking magnesium pills and adding sesame seeds and stuff to my salads and stuff, but that wasn't doing it. So someone said add Ultima. It's a drink mix for ultra runners.
Yep, I see it.
I wasn't the runners at the time. Yeah, yeah, mm-hmm. And it included a lot of the ingredients that you need to stop the cramps, and it worked like magic.
It's kind of wild because I don't, you know, people have been, what is that word, lecturing me about my marathons because I don't drink water when I do marathons. I wait until I finish.
Oh, wow, really?
And it's kind of really dangerous. I'm like, yeah, but I'm afraid of peeing. Because are you afraid of passing out? Apparently not. I'm more afraid of peeing.
Well, you know, if you don't drink the water, at least splash it on your head to cool you down.
Well, I've done that. But yeah.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I've gotten to such a point where, like, when I do my I mean, I run, like, 5 to 10 miles a day, so I don't drink water. I wait till I finish. I used to hydrate like crazy, but the thing when I noticed when I was hydrating, when I was training before, I ended up drinking too much. You know, for some reason, it's like I kind of equate it to when you're at a bar. You keep lifting the drink up and putting something in your mouth. Sometimes when I had the electrolyte drink, I would just keep sipping it for no apparent reason but just to sip it, you know? Even if I didn't need it. But
well,
according to everybody,
yeah,
when
during
you start
my training run, I may have a little bit of water before the race, but after the race, I would have, like, you know, something salty to replenish all the salts and stuff,
as well
as the Ultima I would add to the water. But, yeah, during the marathons, I would definitely – I take a Camelback with me, a little sip. Just to keep me going. I'm not worried about peeing so much because I'm a guy, but I can find it. but yeah.
No, it's well the first time I ran the LA Marathon. Which one? Seaweed strips.
Oh, someone recommended seaweed strips as well to help stop cramping on really hot days.
Huh.
So I don't know if you there's a lot more Asian stores, but those also work too.
Huh. That's something to try. But,
so I have to ask, how did you get into running? I saw your before and after pictures on Facebook. You made quite a body transformation in a short period of time.
I've been running off and on for since I was 15, you know. But then I'd start drinking again at 17 and lose it. And then the year 2000, I broke up with this girl I really cared about. And instead of drinking, because I had already quit drinking, I ended up running a lot. You know, like an overabundance, like every day I was running just to try to get over it. And then I'd stop again. And then just, I think about 3 years ago, when the girl I used to go out with kept pushing me to get back in shape because I talked about it and how much I enjoyed it. And then I got back into it. So I go to the gym for about an hour, then I run every morning. And that's my routine. I mean, I enjoy it. I don't know. I mean, it's kind of like I get high, you know, I get really high and it's really meditative. I mean, you probably know it. You tend to like get really lost in it when you're running. And it's like,
Just let your mind go.
I discover new challenges. It's like, there's this place called Runyon Canyon. I found a back weighted, run. And it turned out to be a big old hill where I had to climb and run at the same time. And it's kind of, I like it because, you know, sooner or later, I'm going to run into a race where I'm going to have to face something like that. And I've already done this hill like 2 times. And I'm going to keep doing it till I get faster at it. Because I've noticed when I do half marathons and there's hill in it, I can tell the people who have not trained with uphill because they walk the uphill and I just keep running because I'm used to the uphill. You know what I mean? Because
I do some hill training, but There's a hill. I don't know if you know the Kentucky Marathon, but there's a hill that's 1 mile
up. I've heard of it.
And it's at mile 12. So I thought I was going to walk up like everyone else because you don't want to burn out at mile 12 or mile 13 during a half marathon. Or sorry, it's a full marathon. In Louisville, in St. Louis, I did a race before lockdown, and it's all hills. And it was a really hot day that day. So I just walked up the hills, ran down. And I still finished within the time limit. It was a little over 6 hours, but I was fine because I felt, I felt fresh after. So I think it depends on the runner, but also depends on the day too. But if you love hill training, you can do it. Like definitely.
For me, it's enjoyable because I've gotten used to it. It's like there's this hill called Mount Olympus in LA. It's a straight mile up. I mean, a straight, like really slanted mile up, and I enjoy it because I've gotten used to it. I've ran it 6 or 7 times a week at a time just to keep doing it and to get faster at it. And at one time I did it, which really pissed me off. This dude was on his bicycle, and he did it 5 times on his bike, which I was really impressed because one time on a bike is impressive, but 5 times is like, dude, quit showing off.
Yeah. You know, well, you know, but it's just shows what you can literally train your body to do anything. You know, the body goes where the mind tells it to. The mind is gone, then you're in trouble. So
I just discovered about a week ago, because I work late sometimes, and it's like a 5-minute bus ride home. Then I realized maybe that's like a mile. So it's a mile and a half. So I've been sprinting at home to where I get it down to like 13 minutes, a mile and a half. So it's a nice little sprint home. So I've been sprinting home because, I mean, any form of running counts. And I'm actually putting some energy into the sprint after work. So it feels good to, like, you know, because I don't max out. I mean, when I do a 5K, I'll max out. You know, I'll try being fast. But a half marathon, a marathon, and an ultra, I'm probably going to pace myself so I can, you know, finish. But with the 5 and 10Ks, you're trying, I mean, for me, I'm just trying to see how fast I can go.
Yeah, and you know, I talk to runners who do, like, marathons every weekend. And I thought, geez, that's really hard on your body. But they'll say, like, you know, they'll only really run hard 2 of those marathons during the year. And if they try to do all 50 states, they'll say, I run hard in Hawaii, run hard in Alaska. The rest of the races are just fun runs. Basically, I'll run and walk and talk and whatever. It's just it's my Saturday. I want to enjoy it, or my Sunday. That's so what I do. Yeah. But everything's a fun run for maybe a couple. And I thought, that makes sense. You know,
I'm the same way with the marathons right now. I mean, my best time in the last, I don't know, 5 years has been like 4:04. And I'm happy with that. I mean, I want to get down to Boston qualifying time, but, you know, I'm not there yet. So I'm not going to kill myself to get there. You know,
I have a Boston story. So this was in 2009. I'd run in Chicago. It was my 20th marathon. And it was 20 years after the song Can't Touch This by MC Hammer. So I decided to do the MC Hammer dance to that song at the finish line. And someone saw me and said, hey, are you going to Boston? And I said, look at my time. I said, I can't get to Boston. And he said, wait up. And he worked for Poland Springs, who supplied all the water. He said, here's your pass to Boston. And that's how he got me. And he said, every employee of Poland Springs gets a free pass to the Boston Marathon, but they don't use it. So he gave me one of his coworkers' passes.
And wow.
If you know Boston, like, you have to take the buses in to Hopkinton where it starts, because it's point to point at 7 in the morning, and they don't start the race till 10 or 10:30 based on what wave you're in. So he said, my friend's a cop, he'll pick you up at your hotel and drive you. And I was like, okay. So I get there, like, maybe 5 minutes before race start, you know, and as we're driving down, like, the cops were stopping him, saying, who's the guy in the back? And the cop would say, oh, that's an elite runner from Canada. And I had to cover my mouth to stop laughing. And then as we got to the start line, all the runners look at me because they're angry because they've been waiting around board for 3 hours. Hopkinton's a very small town. You're just standing in the field for 3 hours. You know, so seeing me pull up, I thought, okay, no one likes me. I'm going to go to the end of the pack. And everyone there was a cop. And they said that they get free entries into Boston every year. So I ran with them, and that was my Boston story. And some runners get angry when they tell that story, but I said, you know, the one thing about Boston was once I finished, I said, before I was someone who used to run marathons, that I said, no, I'm a marathoner, you know, because I was around every runner I thought was better than me. And, you know, even with the race kit pickup, like, every runner standing in front of me in lines were like, hey, you're in front of this running magazine. I know you from winning that race and that race. And I was like, wow, this is like Mecca. So maybe at the end of your marathon, do the Can't Touch Me dance and Can't Touch Me dance and see what happens. Maybe you'll get that free entry to Boston.
No, that's a cool story. I mean, you know, I love doing this show because I love talking to people who actually love running. It's like, you know, the more you run, the more you realize everybody. Most runners don't have any bad feelings to other runners. They just support each other, which is kind of cool.
Well, you know, when you train, you're by yourself. But when you run a marathon, it really is a group. I always say the last 10K or the last 6 miles of a marathon is a group run because everyone's encouraging each other to finish. I remember I was doing a race in Mississauga, and there was a group of like five women, I guess middle-aged, and they had all, and they had their trainer with them, and they had told their trainer, "We're done. We're going to finish. Let's call the ambulance to pick us up." And the trainer took his phone out, and I said, "Hey, you know, running 39K, which is equivalent to maybe 24 miles, that's pretty good, you know, on a Sunday morning. But I just know this. If you keep walking, in half an hour, you'll get your medals, and you'll do something that 99% of people can't do. But it's up to you. You can quit." And then the trainer put his phone down and said, "That's the most motivating thing I said that I've heard. We're just going to walk till the end." And so they walked and finished that day. So, but yeah, I could have just ignored them and just kept running. But I thought, no, take the time to say
that.
Well,
yeah, it's just 2 miles. I mean, 2 miles. You get your medal and you finish the marathon. Fuck that. You know, why not?
Yeah. And,
I mean, I agree.
You know, I know a lot of first timers that want to qualify for Boston or want to beat so-and-so. And I'm like, you just want to finish for your first time. If you look at the way I planned for my first marathon, it's changed so much 158 times later. But that changes because every race is different. And sometimes when you're driving to a new city, they don't have the food that you want, or your hotel room is not what you expect, or sometimes you're delayed, so you miss dinner altogether, so you're eating at a fast food. But all those things you have to keep in mind. And especially now that I discovered there's people that run 20 marathons in 20 days, there's no way you, just doing your first marathon, can carry something like this. Like, there's so much going on, right? So don't put that stress on yourself. So.
No, you know, I just wake up and want to do the run and just, you know, finish. And I enjoy the people I meet. I enjoy the community. I just, you know, I mean, it's funny because I lift every day, and people who work out at the gym are a lot different than people who run. I'd rather be around runners than people who I meet at the gym. No offense to the people at the gym, but they're not that nice. As much as runners are, you know.
Well, I find the runners I meet at the gym, I don't always wear my running shirts at the gym, but when I see them and I talk to them, they instantly, like, we're friends right away. Like, when
you run
marathon, 100 marathon, it's like we have this weird bond.
No, it's true, because I run, it's different.
Well, you know, when I started training at the gym, whenever there's a pro athlete around, I'd always ask to train with them. I wouldn't give them money. I'd say, whatever you do, I'll do. Monkey see, monkey do. And after a couple of weeks, they'd say, you know, why are you doing this? Like, are you trying to break into my sport? And I just said, have you ever watched the movie Rocky? And they're like, yeah. And I said, well, if you know that movie Rocky didn't want to win the world titles. He just wanted to go the distance. He didn't care if he lost every round. So this is my Rocky moment. Like, for you, this is a workout. But for me, if I can keep up with you, you know, I'll be happy. So after that, they're a lot nicer, and they kind of explained these things and said, okay, this is what you do. So, yeah.
Well, they get it. Well, I hate to end this because I enjoy talking to you, but we've done more than a half hour. This is why I keep adding minutes to the show, because sometimes you can't do it. And couldn't do it in 20 minutes, so I added 10 more minutes. I'm probably going to add more minutes as the show progresses. But it was great talking to you. When's your next run?
My next run mainly marathon. That'll be in Michigan and Ohio, and that'll be in early July. That's part of their mainly marathons, 20 marathons, 20-day series. So it'll be a double.
Oh, cool.
And, yeah, I'm looking forward to that. I'm glad we spoke. Pardon me?
When's your next ultra?
My next ultra after that will be at the end of September. It looks like there's one in early August in Buffalo, New York, Lake Casadega. It's $10 to run an ultra, and it's sponsored by a beer company. So I think it works out that every 6 miles you get a can of beer. I mean, I don't drink, I'll have other.
Yeah, that'd be wild.
My Camelback to keep me going.
Oh no, that's a good idea, but okay. But, yeah, you know, I'd love to have you again on the show, maybe in a year from now or maybe 6 months, and see where you are, because, it'd be interesting to, you know, keep up with the people I bring on the show, you know.
Yeah, and
progress,
I can
bring
more of the ultra runners as well. This has been a great experience, and I think they would love meeting you.
Oh, no, you know what? Give them my information. If you know of any of them, tell them, feel free to hit me up, and I'll schedule them. You know, poets are easy to get a hold of. Runners, not so much, because I've only been in this community for 3 years.
Okay. Okay, great. Yeah. Well, I look forward to talking to you in 6 months. You have a great race coming up, and Yeah, have a great night. Thanks for doing this for me again.
All right, take care. Thanks a lot.
Okay, bye.
Bye. Now we have Richard, who's going to review a book for us.
All right, well, this is another Flower Song Press book. City on the Second Floor by Matt Sedillo. Matt is a political poet. He writes about what is happening now and his interface with what's out there. And in this particular book, he is roaming the streets of Los Angeles, and he is showing us daily life. And, of course, it's edged with anger and with some compassion, and it's got, like, it's calling stuff out. So, you know, one of the things that he likes to call out is capital's con jobs. One of the lines in one of the poems is, "Promise me the world, then show me the door." I mean, that is the con job, right? And the poems are taking us in the direction of freedom. So really what we have is real-world poetry. We have an engaged voice, an angry voice, and also a compassionate voice. And the other thing is, and strange as it may seem, an optimistic voice. I mean, his poems take us places and show us who we might be if we lived in this better world. So there's a lot of references to past political poetry. He's got not references within the text of the poem, but in this lineage of like the bop gospel of Amiri Baraka, the references to the South African poet Dennis Brutus, people like that. And there's a little bit of self-awareness that comes from Brecht. And of course, Matt is, of course, completely original in this lineage of politically engaged poetry. And I think this is poetry, this is the kind of poetry that we need in a world that is disastrously cold with whiteness and its dreary side effects, bureaucracy, greed, megadeth, money-making prisons, and, you know, the 9,763 forms of despair that we have to cope with. So this is a kind of poetry that refuses to have a nice day. A Matt would rather knock the lid off and take you to a future that you might like to live in. So another great book from Flower Song Press, City on the Second Floor by Matt Sedillo, available directly from the publisher, your local independent bookstore, or Amazon. And that's my review for today.
Yeah, great. And tomorrow we're going to be having a poet friend, Doug Knott. And let me see who our runner will be, because I don't have it off the top of my head like I should. But it's definitely Doug Knott with, let's see, oh crap, Doug Knott and Mike Bellini. Those are two we're going to be talking to. What book will you be reviewing tomorrow?
I'm going to do Charlotte Innes' new chapbook.
Great. Now it's time for the supplement promotion part. Lately, I've been taking 6 a.m. Bolt. I like it. It helps me. It gives me a little more energy on the run, a little more pep. I mean, I run pretty good without it, but I run a little better with it. I recommend Bolt more than I would recommend Sprint and Marathon. I think it's a stronger product. I think Bolt works better. Also, if you use the code POET, you'll get 20% off anything from 6 a.m. Also, I take, to recover, I take ISO away from Insane Labs. I also take the 28 days later when I go to sleep, their Nightmare, and their CNA. I recommend Insane Labs. It's a good company. I like their product. Again, thank you for listening to the show. Thank you for tuning us in. As always, it's always good to promote poetry and running. Thank you for listening to the show.